You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
So welcome back. We're going to get started. So the next part of this program is we're going to turn to a closer examination of the Fed's operating framework and then financial regulations and how they affect the repo market and what role they played in the event, if any. So for the operating framework, we're going to start with that. We have two experts. I think many of you know them. Bill English, Yale University, and former director of monetary affairs at the board, and he'll describe the ample reserve framework. Then we have Bill Nelson, now with the Bank Policy Institute, former deputy director of monetary affairs. And then after their presentations, we'll continue with discussion and take some questions. So I'll turn to Bill.
Okay, thank you very much, Trish, and thanks to Hutchins for inviting me here today. What I'd like to do is talk about three things. I'm going to talk a little bit about policy implementation frameworks as background, talk a little bit about what did the Fed learn in September about reserves demand, and then talk about possible adjustments to the policy implementation framework in light of what the Fed learned. So going back to kind of the pre-crisis era, as many of you know, the Fed had a small balance sheet. It had a low level of reserves. The desk went in every day. It did operations to try to adjust the supply of reserves to intersect the demand curve for reserves at the desired federal funds rate. And that system worked fine. But as Trish noted, after the crisis, that system didn't work anymore. Basically, after QE, the level of reserves was too big. Those sorts of small daily interventions weren't really feasible. So when it came time to lift off, the Fed did a lot of thinking about how to implement monetary policy, and they decided to administer monetary policy with a system of administered rates. So the rate paid on reserves, the IOER rate, and the rate paid on a new overnight RRP facility that took funds from non-banks. At a fixed rate. And that system also proved effective. So when it came time to lift off, the Fed raised the IOER rate. Is that working? No. Raised the IOER rate, raised the overnight RRP rate, market rates moved up, and subsequently, as policy was tightened, those rates were moved further and further, and market rates moved up along with them. Then, of course, we got to balance sheet normalization in 2017, and no decision at that point had been made about what the policy implementation framework would be in the long run. The committee said, we'll learn and we'll make decisions later, which seemed fair enough, and it was only last winter that the committee announced that they were going to go with an abundant reserves framework for policy implementation, abundant but not too abundant. In some sense, they wanted to be at the smallest level of reserves. It was consistent with being kind of on the flat part of that demand curve for reserves. So they were going to operate with a larger system than prior to the crisis. How much larger, as Trish said earlier, they didn't know, and they were quite upfront that they weren't sure. And so they would allow reserves to run down slowly over time. And at some point, market signals would be such that they'd realize they were kind of getting to the point where they were getting to that curve in the demand curve for reserves, and then they'd stop running the balance sheet off. So that gets us to what happened in September. They were learning about reserves demand, and they were surprised. They learned that the demand for reserves was higher and less elastic than they thought. They'd done surveys. They talked to institutions. And they just found that in markets, the reserves demand steepened faster than they thought. And so money market rates rose unexpectedly. And in addition, repo demand was strong at the time, as Trish discussed. Banks didn't step in to provide repo financing, so repo rates spiked quite a lot. So that's my story for what happened in September. And then the question is, okay, so what are you going to do about that? And one thing you could do is add more reserves. That's in some sense what the Fed has done. And a second is you could establish a standing RP facility. So let me take those in turn. So the Fed realized that it allowed reserves to fall to too low a level. So the immediate response was kind of short-run temporary reserves adding operations. The desk got to work. They added reserves, and that stabilized rates and got the situation into a manageable place. And then after some discussion, in the longer run, the committee decided they'd do permanent reserve adding operations. They'd go out and they would buy bills. The purchase of bills was, I think, clever communication, as I think Dan discussed. The purchases really weren't purchases like the asset purchases into the LSAPs. They weren't buying longer-term treasuries to push down term premia to provide more monetary accommodation. This is kind of old-fashioned in a way. It's just doing transactions to add reserves to make policy implementation work better, to work more efficiently. Just had to be much bigger because we now live in a world of kind of jumbo-sized reserves, and so the operations are larger. And that has worked, as Trish showed back at the beginning. Now, you could go even further. You could add reserves, much more reserves. You could move to Dan's really abundant reserve system if you wanted to. That's going to provide a cushion. That's going to help to smooth out the volatility in money markets. You could add reserves until you start getting significant usage of the overnight RRP facility, for example, which has been very, very small for some time. That would provide a cushion of funds that could then be allocated to the private repo markets if rates began to spike. But that would require a bigger role for the overnight RRP program and a bigger role for money market funds in implementing monetary policy. The committee, at least back in 2014, when they discussed these issues in some detail, just wasn't really comfortable with that. They thought that was too big a role for the Fed, too big a footprint. And so they were not inclined to do something like that. My guess is they still aren't inclined to do something like that. So what else could you do? You could do a standing RP facility. It'd be always on at a fixed rate. The hope would be that would lead to automatic increases in reserves. When market rates began to move up, more folks would come to this facility. They'd bring their treasuries, they'd get their cash, and that would put downward pressure again on money market rates. That could be an effective ceiling on money market rates. That would be helpful because we don't really have one of those these days. We used to have one. It was called the discount window. Unfortunately, the discount window is so stigmatized post-crisis, nobody wants to come to it. It just doesn't work very well. And so, in effect, a standing RP facility might be a stand-in for the discount window and providing a cap on market rates. But it would raise a number of questions for the Fed. Two kind of framing questions are, first, the issue of footprint. How big a role does the Fed want in the repo market? Back in 2014, they didn't want that big a role, and so they may still not want that big a role. The second question is effectiveness. How effective would this be? Would market participants want to use it? Would it, too, be stigmatized like the discount window is? So these are tricky tricky issues that you'd have to bear in mind as you think about the structural questions of how would you design a standing RP facility. So three questions there. One is who can participate, presumably the primary dealers. They're the counterparties for OMO, open market operations. Second, I think probably banks, at least healthy banks, of course. Again, that would help cap the funds rate. It also, as Defilato and Eirig have emphasized, could help encourage banks to shrink their reserves holdings. That would lead to a smaller Fed balance sheet. People probably would like that on the whole. Do you want to let others into the program? I think probably not, if you can avoid it, because then that gets the Fed, into a much bigger role in the repo market, doing repo with hedge funds or whoever. And my guess is they wouldn't be comfortable with that. A second issue is what is the collateral? Probably just treasuries. I think you want it as boring as possible, as plain vanilla as possible. Maybe in a time of market stress, you could move to a single tranche program. You could allow Agency debt and agency MBS, for example, as collateral. That would provide some flexibility in times of stress. That might be helpful. But in normal times, I think, just treasuries. Maybe the hardest question is, at what rate do you want to do this? Higher rates would, of course, encourage more market intervention. It would reduce footprint. It would avoid moral hazard. You wouldn't end up with a large group of smaller, perhaps weaker banks borrowing regularly from the Fed through the ERP facility, which you might be pretty uncomfortable about. On the other hand, a lower rate would encourage participation. It would limit stigma. It would make it clear this isn't a penalty rate. This is just something we want you to use. It would limit volatility. Now, as Dan says, I'm not sure how much volatility you want, but it would make the program presumably more effective. So there are, I think, just some hard decisions to be made. I don't expect an answer from the Fed soon on this. I think they'll want to see how the planned purchases of bills and how the bigger balance sheet work, and maybe get through year end and see how things go, and allow firms to learn and to adjust to. Everybody's learning and adjusting in some sense. But if they're still after that, is an amount of market volatility they're uncomfortable with, it certainly is a program that they could engage in. Thanks very much.
I'll do it. Oh, I already got that. Mark.
You're halfway there.
Thank you. So thank you, Nellie and Hutchinson Center for the invitation to be here. So I'm going to take a look, to some extent, sort of the other side of that, but not completely. So I pretty much agree with everything that Bill just said, actually, which is perhaps not surprising since we worked side by side for 21 years. But there are two critical points on which we may disagree. First, what the Fed bumped into in mid-September is the short run, not the long run, demand for reserves. In the long run, the steep part of the demand for reserves is much lower. Second, the cost of the large balance sheet implementation framework the Fed has adopted increases with the size of the balance sheet necessary to operate it. In my remarks, I will address these two points and describe the course the Fed could follow to reduce the level of reserves considerably. And I will argue that doing so is in the interests of the Federal Reserve and the economy. Now, the quantity of reserves that the Fed has judged to be necessary for reserves to be abundant has grown remarkably over time. In April 2008, when the Federal Reserve staff first considered the possibility of operating policy with an abundant reserves framework, staff estimated that the level of reserves that would be needed might be on the order of $35 billion, but could be larger on some days. The assumption rose to $100 billion in 2016, $500 billion in 2017, $600 billion and $600 billion in 2018. Now, it's not possible to know precisely what level the FOMC judged necessary at the beginning of this year when it made its decision to adopt a large balance sheet framework, because the Fed decided to break with its own tradition and not disclose its forecast. However, available information suggests that at that time, the FOMC judged about $1 trillion in reserves was abundant. I'd guess that their current estimate is about $1.5 trillion. Now, why has the Fed's forecast of the minimum abundant level of reserves grown steadily over time? When the Fed completed QE3, reserves peaked at $2.8 trillion, and for nearly a decade, the interest rate on the Fed paid on reserve balances was above the interest rate banks could earn on other similar liquid assets. Over time, banks and their supervisors took actions that made sense in that environment, and they then became accustomed to the resulting important role of reserves in banks' liquidity management. A banker recently provided me an example of this process. When the interest rate on reserves was higher than market rates, her bank elected to hold reserves in an amount equal to its projected cash needs under stress over 1 week, and Treasury securities to cover needs over the following 3 weeks. When the repo rates moved higher than the interest rate on reserves, the bank considered reducing its cash holdings to its projected need over 3 days, still holding Treasury securities to cover the rest of the month. While both arrangements are consistent with liquidity requirements, supervisors would expect an explanation for the reduction in cash, an experience the banker's management decided they would rather avoid, and the bank elected not to make the change. In short, the Fed's estimate of the amount of reserves needed to operate a large balance sheet implementation framework has grown over time because the level needed has risen with the level provided. Now, such a dynamic led the Norges Bank, Central Bank of Norway, in 2010 to switch from a system with abundant reserves to a system with more scarce reserves, which is roughly the reverse of the FOMC's decision in January. When seeking comment on their decision, they indicated, "When Norges Bank keeps reserves relatively high for a period, it appears that banks gradually adjust to this level. With ever-increasing reserves in the banking system, there is a risk that Norges Bank assumes functions that should be left to the market. It is not Norges Bank's role to provide funding for banks. If a bank has a deficit of reserves towards the end of the day, banks must be able to deal with this by trading in the interbank market." The dynamic can also be seen in a graph of the Fed funds IOER spread versus the level of excess reserves. The purple line shows the relationship as the Fed increased the level of reserves, and the orange line shows the relationship as reserves declined in recent years. As can be seen, the interest rate response as reserves has declined has been sharper, suggesting that banks and their supervisors grew accustomed to reserves as a source of liquidity, and it has taken higher spreads to move them off their preferred arrangements than it did to make them willing to hold the reserves in the first place. The dependence of the demand for reserves on supervisory preferences should not have taken the Fed by surprise. In late 2015, I informed the board members in the LISIC, the committee that oversees the supervision of the largest institutions, which I was on, that the FOMC would not be able to shrink reserve balances any lower than the level bank supervisors were encouraging banks to hold. In May 2018, I asked Vice Chair Quarles at a conference if supervisors were telling banks that they have to meet a material part of their high-quality liquid asset requirements with reserves, pointing out that, if so, the FOMC would not be able to get its balance sheet much smaller. The vice chair answered, "I do know that that message has been communicated, at least in some supervisory circumstances, in the past. I would say that that's in the process of being rethought." Now, while it's true that the Fed's two recent senior financial officer surveys did not find that supervisory expectations, guidance, or regulations were important determinants of banks' demand for reserves, that's probably because the Fed did not include those possible reasons as potential responses to its questions on the surveys. Now, in response to a BPI survey conducted in January, many banks judged that supervision and regulation were important, or very important, as reasons for their bank's reserve demand, including Reg YY liquidity monitoring, the LCR, examiner expectations about the composition of liquidity buffers, and resolution liquidity requirements. Now, banks' elevated demand for reserves also reportedly stems from an unwillingness to risk running a daylight overdraft in their accounts at the Fed. Bankers have explained to me that, while a daylight overdraft used to be unremarkable, now, because overdrafts are rare, supervisors want an explanation if one occurs. Now, there is almost a religious disagreement over whether it is costly for the Fed to operate with a large balance sheet. For my part, here are the reasons why I judge that a large balance sheet is costly for the Fed. First, it costs taxpayers money. Term premiums are negative and have been for years. Moreover, the short rates used to calculate those term premiums have been below the IOER rate when the balance sheet is especially large. For both reasons, going forward, every dollar the Fed invests above and beyond the amount of currency reduces expected Fed income over the term of the securities. That's what a negative term premium means. Using conventional estimates, $1.5 trillion in reserves cost the Fed, and therefore taxpayers, about $15 billion a year in seniorage. Second, it reduces the ability of the Fed to conduct QE. The FOMC perceived its ability to expand the balance sheet to be limited because of political considerations. If the Fed starts with a big portfolio, it will have less far to go. Now, while the Fed could engage in another maturity extension program if it held short-dated securities, but some estimates indicate that the MEP was less effective than the other LSAPs. Third, it puts Fed independence at risk. A large balance sheet means large interest payments to large domestic and foreign banks. Eventually, those payments will serve as fodder for those who would attack the Fed. Moreover, a large balance sheet will prove irresistible to Congress as a way to pay for things. For example, consider the financing plank of the Green New Deal. As checks go out, the government's bank, the Federal Reserve, clears the payments by crediting the seller's bank account with digital dollars. In other words, Congress can pass any budget it chooses, and our government already pays for everything by creating new money. But as Dave Lindsay would often remind us when we were drafting the Blue Book, they don't care what we think. The minutes of the November 2018 FOMC meetings may explain what they think. So sorry about the long quote, but potential drawbacks of an abundant reserve regime include the need to maintain relatively sizable quantities of reserves and holdings of securities, and relatively large ongoing interest expenses associated with the remuneration of reserves. But FOMC participants thought that reserve supply could be reduced substantially below its current level while remaining in such a regime. Participants judged that if the level of reserves needed for a regime with abundant excess reserves turned out to be considerably higher than anticipated, the possibility of returning to a regime in which excess reserves were limited and adjustments in reserve supply were used to influence money market rates could warrant further consideration. Now, even though the Fed's estimate of the quantity of reserves necessary to implement the large balance sheet approach has probably been increased by at least half over the past year, the FOMC does not appear to be giving a small balance sheet approach further consideration. In fact, 2 weeks ago, the president of the New York Fed said, "I don't see any real need to seriously reconsider this. The fact that reserve levels are higher than perhaps we were anticipating a year or so ago doesn't fundamentally change this calculus that this is a very effective and efficient way to run monetary policy." Now, if the Fed can get much smaller and it is costly to be bigger, it follows that the Fed should take steps to shrink. To get much smaller, the Fed needs to take three steps. First, the Fed needs to control volatility in reserve balance, including especially those caused by swings in the Treasury General Account and, to a lesser extent, the foreign repo pool. Now, a little background is in order. In 2008, the Fed allowed the Treasury to switch from keeping most of its cash at commercial banks to keeping all of its cash at the Fed. The Treasury initially increased its deposits to help the Fed finance its emergency lending, but the Treasury ended up keeping all of its cash at the Fed because doing so saved taxpayers money when interest rates were near zero. Whereas before the crisis, the Treasury kept about $5 billion at the Fed, the Treasury's deposit is currently about $300 billion and highly variable. Another Fed liability that has increased significantly over time is the foreign repo pool, where foreign official and international holders of accounts at the Fed invest in overnight reverse repurchase agreements. That pool has grown from about $30 billion before the crisis to about $300 billion now. The growth owes in part to the New York Fed's removal of constraints on customers' ability to vary the size of their investments. When the Treasury General Account and the foreign repo pool vary, there is a corresponding equal and opposite change in reserve balances. The Fed can control variability in reserves using repos in the near term, but in the intermediate term, Treasury needs to return to keeping its cash in the private sector, and the Fed needs to reimpose constraints on the foreign repo pool. Now, second, the Fed needs to conduct a re-education campaign for bankers and bank supervisors to root out any unwarranted bias towards deposits at the Fed as a liquid asset and to reinstall the view that collateralized daylight overdrafts are unremarkable and appropriate. Then third, the Fed should then restart the gradual decline in the system's portfolio of securities. The resulting upward pressure on short-term interest rates relative to the IOER rate will lead banks to economize on their holding of reserve balances. Now, these steps will promote a virtuous cycle. Reduced volatility in reserves will allow the Fed to shrink with less risk of turmoil in money markets. Greater willingness to allow banks to substitute treasuries for reserve balances for purposes of meeting liquidity requirements will allow the Fed to shrink further and also reduce the risk of market volatility. And then the increased opportunity costs of keeping deposits at the Fed will lead banks to find alternatives and supervisors to eventually become more comfortable with those alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. So thank you both for those very interesting presentations. I'm going to start with a couple questions just to try to highlight some of the distinctions among the frameworks that you are both talking about. And so let me first start with Bill English. You don't actually seem to be that worried about September's market volatility. And is that right? And then why?
So did that work?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. So I think you're basically right, and I think there are three reasons. One important one, of course, is it's not my livelihood. Not my
okay,
income.
That was not why I was trying to
not my bonus. It's on the line. If financing is expensive for a few days. But leaving that aside, I think the key question here is, do you have a monetary implementation framework that actually allows you to implement monetary policy? And I think they do. They have a system that works. The system with abundant reserves is effective. They can, by moving their administered rates, get rates to come out where they want them to come out. And at least if they leave some additional reserves, as they are now doing, that system is pretty effective, and the volatility in that system seems pretty low. So I think the third piece of why I'm reasonably comfortable is that the desk is much more active. The committee seems comfortable with the desk being more active, taking steps to reduce volatility and kind of ensure they end up with rates trading in the range where they want them to trade. So those things together, I think, make me more relaxed, perhaps, about the September events than a lot of people are. I do take Trish's comment earlier seriously, that this could nonetheless be kind of an indicator of an underlying problem that you need to worry about liquidity and resiliency. So it's worth holding conferences like this, yeah. and thinking about these things. But am I really worried? Not really. No.
Okay, and Bill, I'll let you have an opportunity at that question.
Oh, I would just echo the last part of what Bill said. So in terms of implementing monetary policy, well, it does seem like they're now in a regime where they both have a giant balance sheet and they're actively intervening, which doesn't seem to be providing the benefits hoped for. But more seriously, I'm more worried about the fact that, you know, this happened in a very benign situation in terms of concerns about credit quality, and I think it could well be an indicator that there's a more structural problem that could be much worse in a time when this financial system is weaker.
Okay. So one question I want to get to is something about something called a financial footprint, which the Fed's footprint in the financial markets, which is sort of used in different ways. And I think there's this general view of it's good for the Fed's footprint in the market to not be too big. Now, I think that means different things to different people. So I'm kind of curious, in both frameworks, I think both of you would say that your framework, one with a smaller balance sheet, one with ample reserves or abundant reserves, both have smaller financial footprints. So could you just sort of, you know, talk about what you mean by financial footprint and how your framework means the Fed has a less imprint in the market? So, Bill, you want to start with that?
Both Bill.
This was a standard problem all through for the last 20 years.
But sure, I'll start. So the question of footprint arose in a big way in 2014 as the committee was thinking about their policy implementation framework that they wanted to move toward over the longer run. And I guess I took it to mean that the policymakers didn't want to operate in great size, at least, in markets or with counterparties that weren't the traditional markets and counterparties in which it operated. And so it came up in particular in 2014 around the overnight RRP program and their desire that that program be small and that they not end up doing operations with money market funds in size every day. But rather most of their operations being with banks through the payment of interest on reserves. So I think an ample reserve system of the sort that they've outlined with kind of a lowish level of ample reserves means that the overnight RRP program is small. They're not having to do a whole lot of RRPs once they finish buying the bills. I think they're hoping that they won't have to do a lot of RRPs.
Hope is an answer.
It is a strategy. Sometimes it's all you got. Mostly the Fed will just be operating through the banking system in kind of a way that they're comfortable with. So that's the idea. Whether in fact, as Bill and I were just joking about, I mean, whether they can get to a size that actually allows them to not have to be doing operations in a fairly high frequency way is unclear. They may have to operate with a somewhat bigger balance sheet than they wanted, but I think they can find a size that works if they want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Bill, you talk about shrinking the balance sheet and, you know, implementing monetary policy. How does that work to keep the footprint out?
So to put my cards on the table, yeah. I'm actually one of the few people who thinks the Fed should go back to conducting policy the way it did before the crisis. Now, before the crisis, the Fed conducted small operations with broker-dealers in the repo market. The broker-dealers were not dependent upon those operations. The rate that they cleared at, the Fed didn't care about. And it used those operations to manipulate the supply of reserves in the federal funds market. It cared about the federal funds market, but it wasn't actually operating in that market. So it had very good control of supply and demand in a relatively small market that it wasn't operating in, and that rate was well transmitted into the rest of the economy. Now, just to see how different things are now, if you add up, and this is kind of not good economics, but if you add up the assets and liabilities from the Fed's balance sheet pre-crisis that were with entities other than the U.S. government and currency, so all foreign entities, private entities, pre-crisis, that number was $66 billion, and it represented 4% of the sum of assets and liabilities. Right now, that number is $1.99 trillion. So it's $2 trillion, and it's about 25% of the Fed's balance sheet. So, I mean, the Fed is on a path of being much more involved in being part of the financial system. It has, and I think that the really scary prospect is if the Fed takes the step to decide that it needs to control the repo rate, or if it even says, well, we're going to control a range of rates, and that includes the repo rate, then it's going to have to try to control a trillion-dollar market instead of a relatively small market in which it does not control supply or demand, and it's going to have to do it with its standing overnight RRP facility and potentially a standing RP facility, be on both sides of that market, and it's going to take very large transactions to do it, and it's effectively going to be the clearer of that market at first resort.
Mm-hmm. And can you just... entertain the idea of changing the target rate, or are you just...
Oh, no, yes, absolutely has. It's come up over the time in FOMC meetings, and it's sort of often been mentioned favorably by the New York Fed. And I know Joe and Brian, for example, on a piece recently, Brian Sack, who was the former desk operator, called for the Fed to target the repo rate.
Right. I'm going to have just one more question, then we'll turn to the audience. So there's been a fair amount of confusion about intraday liquidity, and Bill Nelson, you raised the idea of daylight overdrafts, and could you just expand on that? And there seems to be some reserves, the need for reserves to meet intraday payments, and so some demand for reserves coming from that, but also the ability to use daylight overdrafts. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, happy to. So BPI, we've actually had three symposiums now on the growing pressure in reserve markets that became apparent about a year or so ago. And in the second one, actually, which was 4 or 5 months ago, bankers said the biggest determinant of their cash needs is actually their intraday needs. And I wish I'd paid more attention to that then, because that story became a big part of it. That was mentioned prominently in the Fed in response to the Fed's senior financial officer service, because that was one of the reasons they did give the banks. Large banks experience a significant flow in their cash holdings over the course of the day. Payments go out at the beginning of the day, that runs down their reserves, and then they come back in at the end of the day. Now, if you go back pre-crisis, banks would typically run a daylight overdraft. The Fed wanted them to run daylight overdrafts. It was how the system worked. And in 2011, the Fed changed its payment system risk policy to establish collateralized daylight overdraft specifically to sort of promote that operation. During the day, their accounts run negative, and then they come back positive, and that's all collateralized.
Right.
But those overdrafts have become so rare because there's so much cash, the reserves are so high, that people didn't run daylight overdrafts. And now, if you run a daylight overdraft, it's actually something fairly extraordinary, and your supervisor is going to want to know, well, why did you run a daylight overdraft? Now, I've also heard from various sources that that you are not allowed to anticipate running a daylight overdraft in your Title I resolution plans, and that's contributed to the view among bankers that, well, we really shouldn't run daylight overdrafts. Now, in terms of the repo volatility, you know, late in the morning, once the pressure started to materialize, that was when banks were at their low ebb of cash, and they weren't willing to just redeploy it and risk running a daylight overdraft.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let me turn to the audience for questions. There are some microphones. Please say your name. We'll start with Joe. Can you stand up and the microphone will come to you? And
thank you. I'm Joe Gagnon, a Peterson Institute for International Economics and a former colleague of all three of you. So my question's for Bill English, but I think Bill Nelson will probably want to chime in too. So you gave a good explanation of how the committee is thinking about these issues, including the standing RP facility, which is the other thing that Brian Sack and I recently wrote about. So just to put, we favor that, but I didn't get a good sense of how you feel about it yourself. You more characterized how the committee's thinking, so I'd like to hear, and in particular the previous panel, people talk about moral hazard, and if we had this facility permanently out there, would that cause banks to be overly, not sufficiently concerned about managing their liquidity? But I guess my question is, well, if moral hazard is usually a concern if it leads to a harmful catastrophe like your house burning down, and that's bad for everyone. In this case, if it leads to banks turning to the Fed for funding at no cost to the taxpayer, because these are I'm referring to only funding government-guaranteed securities, so with a reasonable haircut and a surcharge, whatever the spread would be, the Fed would, if anything, make money. There's almost no risk of loss. So what's the harm in telling banks and regulators they don't need to spend a lot of valuable resources worrying about that risk when it's a risk the Fed can easily offset, and forcing banks to worry about the other risks in financing the rest of their portfolios?
Okay. Thank you. Other questions right now?
Hi, Gina Smilek, New York Times. Bill English, this is also a question for you, and kind of along the same lines. But you mentioned this idea that the Fed has noted in the minutes and elsewhere that, like the discount window, there's a chance that a standing repo facility would face a stigma. And I'm just curious what your view is on that. Do you think it's likely that there would be a stigma, and how important is where that rate is set to whether that stigma exists?
Want to take those questions right now on what do you
sure.
think of a standing repo facility?
I'm going to give a couple of answers, but then I'm going to pass to Bill, because he actually has a nice paper on do we need liquidity regulation and lender last resort, which I think gets at Joe's point, right? It's, if you can do this for free, why not do it? Why do we make banks hold lots of costly liquidity? So that's up your alley, I think. So do I think an RP facility is a good idea? Basically, yes, I do. I think one for broker-dealer, primary dealers and banks would be very helpful. I worry that the discount window doesn't work. We need to have some sort of safety valve for money markets, and that safety valve could be an RP facility, and so I think that would be helpful. I think the questions that I listed earlier are real, and the hardest one for me is the rate. So what is the rate that you want? So what am I worried about? I guess I would worry a bit that if I said we're going to have an RP facility, it's going to be open to all DIs, and you set a rate such that 1,000 DIs were using it every day, because for them it was not a rate that that was unattractive. It was a rate that was attractive. They're small. They're in markets where deposit markets aren't that great, and they're paying higher rates. And so for them, this is a great marginal cost of funds. I guess I'd worry about that. I'd worry that's causing distortions. But that's why I wouldn't want to set a really low RP rate. But how high I think is hard, and this gets to your question. I think if it's too high, it will look like a penalty rate, and it will look like this isn't something you're supposed to do. You're only using it because you screwed up, and then there are problems, and your name will be published in 2 years under the new rules. So I think it's just hard to say. I mean, currently, the discount rate is 50 basis points above the top of the Fed funds target. So lower than that, because as Joe said, this is really safe, good collateral. How much lower, I don't really know. I'd have to think hard and get more information than I have about kind of how much take-up do you think you would get as you move that rate down. I think that would be the question for me.
And I also wrote something more recently.
Turn on the mic.
Please, yeah.
Well, you were right on that. I also wrote something more recently on challenges with the standing repo facility. Just to follow up a little bit and amplify what Bill said, in 2003, the Federal Reserve went from a below-market rate using a facility called adjustment credit to an above-market rate, something called primary credit. That was intended, primary credit, adjustment credit was a facility with a lot of rules and a lot of stigma, and the objective was to go to primary credit, which had no rules. It was going to be a rate ration thing alone with a fairly strict credit quality requirement to reduce stigma, to make it simple. And it took it took from 1999 or so to 2003 to really get it done. And because of what Bill's describing, it was very difficult to come up with a system that you could just sort of let it operate by itself, and yet people would choose to use it only when there was pressure and not use it too much. And those terms had to work for I think there's about 10,000 depository institutions out there when you count all the little credit unions that can all borrow from the Fed. And you don't need thousands of them to want to borrow all the time to have a problem. You just need five or six of them to want to borrow all the time to have a crop problem. The Fed doesn't want to be the Federal Home Loan Banks. So I think it could be a problem. I mean, I think it could be a real challenge to stand such a facility up. You could open it for just the primary dealers, but I'm not sure how helpful that would be. But to get to the deeper question of moral hazard, I tend to agree that the moral hazard associated with a facility that converts treasuries for cash would be pretty de minimis. Because really, I mean, moral hazard, in my view, is mostly a problem when there's a question about the solvency of the institution or maybe the quality of the collateral. And I don't think that would be the case in either circumstance. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions right now? Please. Be brief, please. You let it your name and a brief question, please, and we get a couple more.
Sure, you. Josh Younger. I guess one of the themes that's emerging is there's plenty of cash. It's just not where it needs to be, when it needs to be. And we haven't really talked about the federal funds market very much, and that's supposed to be the solution. Like, distributional issues are supposed to be resolved through that market. So I guess the fact that Fed effective volumes went down on the 17th of September, and it's turned into this very bilateral market, FHLB's lending and so forth, like, keeping it brief, I guess. But, like, the fact that Fed funds doesn't trade, are you concerned about that? And if we wanted to trade, how do we incentivize that in this current environment?
I saw a couple others right there. Stand up, George. There we go.
Yeah, George Selgin from Cato. Some other countries, of course, have similar facilities to the standing repo facility and seem to manage corridor systems using them. Why should it be more of a problem for us? What's different about us? That's for both speakers, of course. Mm-hmm.
And can you stand up? And yes, Micah. Yeah.
Thank you. Micah Green with Steptoe & Johnson. Picking up on your point about primary dealers or
beyond primary dealers, if the collateral is treasury. What we heard in the previous panel is that there does seem to be some concentration risk in the marketplace, and there's not enough breadth of demand. There may be plenty of cash, but it may be concentrated in too few entities. What would be the problem with having a facility, if it was based on treasuries, with having a broader set of access to it to broaden out the market demand?
Do you want to start? We have a few questions about Fed funds market, trading.
So I'll take a stab at these, but then Bill can clean up after me, as he did for so long. So the first question was, gee, there's a lot of reserves out there, but they're not where they're supposed to be. Why aren't we seeing more Fed funds trades? I don't know in some sense exactly why. I think partly it's because, as Bill was describing earlier, the demand for reserves by some firms is really strong. They don't want to trade Fed funds much. They don't want to be providing Fed funds. So I guess the question is, as we were discussing over lunch, there's a high level of reserves, but is it really high relative to what people really want to have for these various regulatory reasons? Repo facilities have been used. Different central banks use different ways of implementing monetary policy. You certainly could implement monetary policy using a repo facility and an RRP facility, very much along the lines that Joe and co-author have discussed. So that certainly is a possibility. I think the FOMC in the past has just been concerned about dominating that market. And it requires large operations and operations with a lot of firms, and that just is something they've not wanted to do as part of their implementation process. And I'm sorry, the third question was
the concentration of primary dealers, and is that affecting the way arbitrage or willingness to make markets?
I guess I don't feel like I have enough knowledge about those markets to answer that.
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, and also, like my career, I've always been one step behind you. and you also give all the good answers first. So I think the big surprise about the Fed funds market is not how small it is, but the fact that it exists at all. I mean, since the QEs, there really shouldn't be a Fed funds market. I mean, so for a long time, it was FBOs borrowing from GSEs who don't get interest on reserve, and it was the FBOs because they don't pay FDIC premiums, so they were the marginal borrower. And now, as you point out, it's FHLBs trading with larger institutions that it's an LCR play. It reduces their LCR to do that. It's effectively like, you know, the Fed could have paid interest on reserves to banks with odd ABA numbers and not the ones with even ABA numbers, and then switch it in order to have a Fed funds market. But the way to get the Fed funds market back is to continue to shrink until you get enough separation between market rates and IOER that banks will want to economize on their holding. And so at the end of the day, if they have extra reserves, they'll trade around with that. Now, that's going to, you know, well, to get more detail would take a very long answer, I think. But another question was, why not open a standing repo facility for more institutions? And I think the answer there really is it would just really scare the bejesus out of people. So the people that you would want to open it to that wouldn't have access because they're banks or branches or primary dealers would to a large extent be hedge funds who are big borrowers in the repo market. And the Fed's been saying, look, this is nothing like 2008, and they're right. And they have the authority under Section 14 to do open market operations with anyone against against Treasury agency collateral. So they could open it up for hedge funds. But I think that, honestly, if they did, people would really say, well, wow, I think that something's really, really, really going bad out there. Now, there's one more question about
concentration.
What was the other question about? What's that? No, that was the one I just
said. That
answered.
Is the one, which we can take into the next session because we have enough people on that topic.
Oh, that's right. So when designing the primary dealer facility, I was actually on the team that interviewed other countries to talk about why didn't the Bundesbank experience stigma with their I forget what it's called now, their facility, their above market facility, and then that was sort of what the ECB adopted. And what I was told by the person who ran the facility was, because to be clear, the Fed has had stigma problems probably since its inception, at least for 50 years. It is not a new thing. And his point was, don't have all these rules. Don't, you know, and sort of don't make it into, make it and make it common. That was his view. I think it also has to do with the fact that the Fed has always used one facility to be both its monetary policy facility, putting a ceiling on rate, and also its first go-to facility when there's an emergency. So when you combine those things, you know, it looks like something's gone wrong if you're using your backup liquidity source. But
okay. So join me. Thank you, this panel. Very nice panel. So this last panel is going to focus on specific the role of financial regulations. And we structured this where I asked each of them to focus on a particular regulation, explain what it is with no acronyms if possible, what it does, how it might have played a role in repo, and then each will just briefly describe that piece, and then we'll have a broader discussion about sort of all of them together. So, but I'm going to start with, so we have four panelists here who many of you know are experts. Sean Campbell is now with the Financial Services Forum, was previously at the board in both BSNR and the research division. We have Tim Clark, also previously at the Federal Reserve Board, BSNR, head of supervision. Something of supervision. Jim Wigand.
Who's counting? Who's counting?
Jim Wigand, previously head of complex financial institutions at FDIC, and Sandy O'Connor, who was just recently retired from J.P. Morgan as chief regulatory officer. So we'll go each. There's a timer over here. Each of you have been asked like to keep it somewhat brief so we can have a conversation. So we're going to start with Sean. Thank you.
So Nellie, thanks very much for the invite today, and thanks to the Hutchins Center. I think this is a really important topic and happy to have the opportunity to engage in the conversation. So, you know, while our focus today, quite appropriately so, the main focus today is thinking about the more recent repo market volatility that we saw in the past, you know, few weeks or few months or whatever. I really think it's very hard to understand where we are in the repo market without understanding how we got here. And so if you think about the repo markets more generally, both in the U.S. and abroad, have been deteriorating for several years. And people in the repo markets and more broadly well understand that. So in 2017, the Committee on the Global Financial System, which is essentially a consortium of central banks, including the Federal Reserve, published a study, a really good study, on the functioning of repo markets that I would suggest everybody who's interested in this topic take a look at. And that report found pretty conclusively that repo markets have been deteriorating, that have been sort of their robustness has been declining over time, and they cited a variety of evidence supporting that, including higher costs to end users and lower volumes and lower liquidity in the repo market. So if you think about a very basic analogy, in the repo market has been deteriorating. In some sense, the plane is flying a little bit closer to the ground than it used to be. So any bit of turbulence has the potential to do more damage. It's going to be tougher to control. And so I think that, you know, having that as a background is actually quite important. And if you think about that background, capital is actually quite relevant for thinking about that background. So in particular, there are two types of capital regulations, which I'm going to talk about today, leverage ratios and the G-SIB surcharge. So a leverage ratio is a risk-blind capital requirement that measures equity relative to total assets without any, or in some cases, in the case of the supplementary leverage ratio, hardly any regard to risk. As a result, leverage ratios penalize an asset if it is low risk, like cash or U.S. Treasuries. A bank that intermediates repos between suppliers and demanders of cash will face heightened capital unrelated to its risk profile that just makes it less economic to intermediate low risk and low return assets like repo. The 2017 report presents data and analysis that specifically identified the leverage ratio as a cause of reduced repo activity. Moreover, a variety of academic researchers, including Daryl Duffy from Stanford University, have published a variety of research pieces showing that the leverage ratio is having a real and binding impact on the repo market. The second capital charge that I would talk about is the G-SIB capital surcharge. So the G-SIB capital surcharge is a capital surcharge that's only faced by G-SIB, basically the largest, most important banks across the globe, and in particular in the U.S. It's an extra capital buffer that applies to those G-SIBs based on some notion of their systemic footprint, where their systemic footprint is essentially a quantity that is determined by regulation. It's effectively a regulatory assessment of systemic footprints. And in the context of measuring that systemic footprint, much of the problem that exists with the leverage ratio also exists inside the G-SIB surcharge, in the sense that many of the factors that that determine your G-SIB surscore are effectively risk blind. So the simplest one to articulate is size. So overall balance sheet size is a factor that determines your G-SIB surcharge, and size is risk blind. If you have $100 in treasuries or $100 in corporate bonds, your size is 100. So to the extent that size-related factors and other risk-blind factors are components that have a perceptible influence on the G-SIB surcharge, that's also another source of basically a risk-blind capital requirement, which makes it less economically compelling to engage in low-risk, low-return activities that previous research and the CGFS report and sort of other sources have shown have led to a broad decline in the robustness of the repo market over the past several years. So that's sort of how we got to where we are today. If we think about where are we today and what's going on, there are also components of these capital capital charges or capital requirements that have sort of more acute effects that might be at play for understanding some of the short-term volatility that we've seen in the past and may see in the future. So in particular, turning back to the G-SIB surcharge, and Governor Tarullo already sort of covered much of this in remarks, so I'll just sort of recap some of the points that he made. You know, There are two parts of the G-SIB surcharge which contribute to sort of this possible volatility in repo markets and potentially elsewhere. So the first is that the G-SIB surcharge is set up in such a way, it's specified so that your capital charge jumps by 50 basis points every time your score jumps by 100 basis points. And to be clear, if you jump to the next bucket by 1 point, you have a 50 basis point higher capital surcharge. And for a large G-SIB, that means $5 to $10 billion more in equity financing, which is significant. So the existence of a capital surcharge where you move in chunky buckets, economists call that a cliff effect, where there are cliff effects, basically creates a system in which you can have very big and abrupt changes to your capital surcharge. And if you're a bank, and if your G-SIB surcharge is very close to that bucket or a little bit above it as we get close to the end of the year, you're going to have a very significant incentive to want to manage your capital, as you well should, and try and get below that G-SIB capital surcharge level. The second point, which Governor Tarullo also mentioned in his remarks, is that a variety of the measures, not all of them, but a variety of the measures are based on the value of certain balance sheet variables on December 31st of the year in which the G-SIB surcharge is going into effect. So this is another example of a design feature of the G-SIB surcharge, which just means that you potentially have much more volatility in your G-SIB surcharge, because as you get close to the end of the year, whether your G-SIB surcharge score is 100 or 101 is going to depend on whatever is going on 12/31 in that year. So those two things together sort of provide for cliff effects and incentives that lead a bank in many instances to want to manage its G-SIB surcharge towards the end of the year. When a bank wants to manage its G-SIB surcharge towards the end of the year, how is it going to do that? Most of the components that enter the G-SIB surcharge are sticky and are relatively hard to move in a moment's notice. So if you think about corporate loans, consumer loans, mortgages, you can't basically increase and decrease those things very quickly. What can you increase and decrease relatively quickly? Repo, OTC derivatives. Things like that are easier to move on a dime, and so those are the things that in some sense bear the brunt when the G-SIB surcharge comes into play. So I think capital, it may not be the thing that's at the top of the list, but capital, in particular the leverage ratio and the G-SIB surcharge, should be on the list for discussion about the incentives that they create that may have had something to do in sort of the repo, the repo activity that we saw a couple months ago, the repo activity we may see as we get to the end of this year, and also the repo sort of kerfuffle that we saw at the end of last year which happened and which was real, but just didn't create as much of a media splash as the one this September. So I guess the final, am I up? Cool. All right. So in the last 45 seconds, I briefly want to cover what I think people should be doing about this. So in the 2017 report, the issuers of that report said that people ought to be really monitoring the repo market on an ongoing basis very closely, and I think that regulators and the public should take that to heart. And in particular, I think that a lot of the analysis that was conducted in that report could be usefully sort of extended to the modern period on an ongoing basis for further review and consideration by regulators like the Federal Reserve and the public, and that should be made public for all to see. If you think about what happened during the flash crash, which is not exactly analogous to what happened in the context of the repo market, but it was a sharp market event, happened at one point in time, regulators and the government, they took a considerable deliberative period of time, they studied it, they wrote a report, they made those results public, and I think that did a lot to improve public transparency and understanding. I think much the same could be done here. The second thing is that regulators should be actively thinking about how bank regulations can impact other markets. I think we've heard that from a variety of other speakers here today, and I think that's really crucial, and I think that that's something that has not gotten enough attention in the context of the financial reform movement over the past 10 years, in that the way that you regulate banks definitely has the potential to impact the way other markets operate and other markets get intermediated, and that really matters and should be included when bank regulators are thinking about bank regulation. And then the final thing that I'll say is that I think it's really important to understand that details matter. Details really matter. God is in the details. And some of these things about, cliff effects in the G-SIB surcharge and the risk insensitivity in certain capital charges, and other people talk about liquidity rules, those details and getting those details right is really crucial, and that regulators and the public really need to be attuned to thinking about those details.
Okay, great. Thank you, Sean. So we're going to turn to Tim Clark.
Okay, great. Thanks. I think it's really, really great to be here, and thanks to Brookings for hosting a very timely event that's, I think, gained much more interest than actually I would have assumed, as Nellie referred to in her opening comments. You know, there have been a lot of different claims about the possible causes of what happened in September, specifically the repo rate spike, which is, I think, what we're here to talk about. It's great to talk about them all in one place, light them all up, and take a look at them. I would say, from my perspective, of all of the claims of the causes and the associated solutions that have been associated with these claims, the least compelling have been about banking regulation and supervision. There's really been no factual evidence provided of any direct impact from the regulations to what happened in September. Unlike with many of the other things discussed today, including the shrinkage of the Fed's balance sheet, the growth in supply of treasuries, growth of the treasury account, et cetera. Also, unlike some of those other factors, the regulations haven't changed recently, as Governor Trula mentioned earlier. They've been in place for a while, and regular periodic spikes in treasury repo rates do happen, and it hasn't required the Fed to step into the market. And then lastly, the claims about the damages being caused by supervision and regulation have covered literally every key element of the post-crisis enhancements. So it starts to feel like some of this is just being seen as a really good opportunity to pressure the Fed into weakening important post-crisis rules. If there's real concerns about what's going on and not just an attempt to use this to garner such changes, I kind of encourage everyone to take a little bit of a deep breath on the regulation and supervision side. We're not in a crisis, as has been amply discussed today. Thoughtful, fact-based deliberation is needed. It appears the Fed is doing that. I think that's great. I'm going to come back later to the Fed's comments yesterday about the comprehensive liquidity analysis and review.
I promise I'd ask. Okay.
While there remain questions about what's happened in the repo markets, what's not in question is that the stronger post-crisis regulations and supervision have made the largest banks more financially resilient, and that has made the system safer. My view, still not safe enough. There's much more work to do to reduce probability that could cause another grave crisis. But going in the opposite direction and hastily making changes that increase the probability of failure at these banks by weakening capital and liquidity rules isn't a good answer to any question, frankly. And I certainly don't think it's a good answer to how to address the repo market issues. I think a lot more thought needs to go into that relationship. So now I will actually turn to liquidity, which is what I was asked to talk about. The introduction of liquidity regulations was a huge and important development. And it has made the banks more resilient to a range of potential problems, including the type that directly contributed to the financial crisis. Pre-crisis, quantitative liquidity requirements were minimal at best, and banks' risk management and bank supervision in this area were, to be kind, not well-developed. So let me briefly discuss the two most important ones that have come up, really the two things that are, exist. The liquidity coverage ratio, sometimes called the LCR, and the comprehensive liquidity assessment and analysis and review. So the LCR, the liquidity coverage ratio, as I mentioned before, so put simply, it requires each of the largest banks to hold a pool of high-quality liquid assets sufficient to cover stressed level of net outflows over a 30-day period. Seems pretty reasonable. Those outflows are expected to be higher the greater the use of less stable funding, such as short-term wholesale funding. So all things equal, the more stable the bank's funding sources, the smaller the pool of high-quality liquid assets it has to hold. Put slightly differently, the required size of the liquidity pool is appropriately a function both of the bank's size and how it manages to, how it chooses to manage and fund its operations. These are actually business decisions that banks make. For today's discussion, what's gotten the most attention is what counts as a high-quality liquid asset. Treasury securities and excess reserves at the Fed are treated equally and are both considered of the highest quality, as has been noted frequently. So the LCR does not constrain a bank from lending cash into the repo market to buy treasury securities, full stop. Doing so has no negative impact on this measure of liquidity at all. But it's also important to think about banks' internal liquidity risk management practices, which is a good segue to the comprehensive liquidity analysis and review program that the Fed put in place after the crisis, often referred to as the Fed's liquidity stress test. Just to be really clear on that, CLAR is not a Federal Reserve-run liquidity stress test. There are no specific quantitative threshold requirements that banks have to meet associated with CLAR. CLAR is an assessment of banks' internal liquidity risk management practices, including their use of liquidity stress testing and other liquidity metrics and risk management processes. It's an easy thing to pick on in a way because this is supervision, and supervision actually is not as transparent as sometimes I'd like it to be. I was going to stick to script and not run out of time here, so let me stop that. This type of supervisory program is critically important because, like any regulation, the liquidity coverage ratio cannot account for all situations at all banks, including that a bank might structure its position specifically to meet regulatory requirements while ending up with the same risk in a different form that's not captured by the regulation. This is one of the reasons supervision is so valuable. Simply meeting the LCR does not mean a bank can stop worrying about liquidity risk, and it's appropriate that the supervisor assess how good and how thoughtful the banks are at worrying about this. To look at how or if the bank's vulnerabilities that aren't captured by the LCR are finding their way into banks' internal considerations about capital, actual liquidity needs under stress. Okay, I'm actually going to just move this one aside, I guess. If you're going to ask the question, I will. So one last point in closing, their capital and liquidity regulations can and do affect banks' business decisions, and they may constrain their activities if you define constraint as attaching a higher cost to a bank, the greater its level of risk and the risk it represents to the system. They don't actually restrict the engagement in those activities. What they mean is they need to have appropriate levels of capital and liquidity to support them. The post-crisis regulations increase the level of confidence we can have in the largest banks that they can withstand another severe downturn, not turn it into a full-blown crisis. That's a critical goal. In my view, that level of confidence actually should be and could be higher still. And I think capital standards could be and should be higher still. And importantly, you know, addressing the too-big-to-fail problem via resolution planning and trying to, you know, set up a system where you can resolve a massive bank in a time of stress without disruption is far from complete. In the meantime, we're left with the critical importance of the other key pillar of addressing this problem, which is reducing the probability of default at these banks in the first place. Those are strong capital and liquidity requirements. That's how you do that. If for some reason it's determined that liquidity standards should be loosened because of these events, which I really think would be a mistake, and you know, maybe there's more information that will come out, and like I said, it should give a thoughtful consideration, I think there will be a need for significant offsetting increases in capital requirements to leave the system as just simply unchanged from its current level of safety, which, as I already mentioned, I think should be higher. So I'll stop there.
Okay, there's nothing worse than starting a discussion about resolution planning and already seeing some members of the audience yawn. I mean, this is actually going to be a hopefully good tie-in to some of the comments made earlier with respect to how resolution planning, which some of you may be asking, can relate to the repo market. Large financial companies are required to develop plans for early resolution under the U.S. Bankruptcy Code. Now, unlike the FDIC's authorities for resolving banks' or insured depository institutions under the FDI Act or systemically important financial companies under Title II, where the FDIC can either use working capital from the Deposit Insurance Fund for resolving banks or have a borrowing line with the Treasury to resolve a systemically important financial institution under Title II. The companies that have to put together the Title I resolution plans under the bankruptcy code have to rely on private sector sources to fund their bankruptcy. Now, what was the largest source of private sector funds ever to be used in a bankruptcy? $10 billion. That's it. So that's the largest source of external funds to fund a bankruptcy, $10 billion. So the regulator said, look, institutions, in order to develop plans that we're going to view as being realistic and feasible to execute, you're going to need to rely on internal funds to be used as working capital to basically fund your bankruptcy. What this meant is that the entities had to do two things. They had to model the quantum or the amount of working capital or liquidity they're going to need in order to work through their bankruptcy. And I'm using the term working capital there both in the context of ensuring that the amount of liquidity is sufficient to keep, in order to execute the plan appropriately and keep the operations that need to be operating doing so, okay? And because, I mean, there are certain operations that are performed by these companies that you don't want to cease. So it's both the liquidity necessary to do that and then also the actual capital amount that is necessary in order to ensure that they satisfy regulatory requirements and that market confidence is maintained, that those entities have the ability to do it, okay? So to some extent, you know, we're talking about both capital and liquidity here. And in both cases, both have to be modeled. And in that modeling, the institution's plan itself drives the quantum that is necessary in order to be identified as the successful amount for plan execution. So in that modeling, depending on what the plan contemplates, the entities themselves will develop a set of assumptions. The regulators don't impose assumptions on the entities because each plan is idiosyncratic based on the footprint, the business model, the characteristics of the entity itself. And so, you know, a blanket set of assumptions really isn't realistic. So they're dependent on the entities to develop the assumptions themselves for this type of modeling. Now, one of the expectations, though, is that if you're monetizing assets, you're going to have to look at a realistic market reaction to what you're going to recover in converting that asset from something other than cash into cash. And so the rate at which you're monetizing an asset and the market step and ability to monetize that asset at a certain price is something the regulators are going to be looking at. This is something which we've heard is an incentive for cash versus treasuries, because if a high volume of treasuries are being monetized at one point in time, then there's going to be a discount imposed by the market because you're putting all these treasuries, monetizing them in the market, so there's going to be a discount provided on it, and that discount is something which indicates a preference for cash. Now, there's no stated preference in any of the guidance that is provided by either the Fed or the FDIC on resolution planning. There's no stated preference for using reserves in the resolution process. However, it is a market reality, and I think a very realistic assumption, that if an asset class is being monetized in the market, that a realistic view as to what the market is willing to pay for that asset has to be taken into consideration. And that's what basically the regulators do when they review the resolution plans. So how does all of this end up relating to business as usual? Because when we're talking about resolution, none of these institutions today are in resolution that may participate in the repo market. And resolution, at least for now, is a hypothetical exercise. So how does this relate to basically their ability to participate in the repo market today? Well, the amount of liquidity that gets calculated, it's positioned within the entity, and it's positioned based on what the needs are in for resolution planning purposes, where the needs are in order to successfully execute the plan. The quantum is also, that pool of liquidity, that quantum, that amount, is also combined with satisfying the other regulatory requirements Tim alluded to with respect to prudential supervision, safety and soundness. So you're looking at the entities using this pool of liquidity basically to say, all right, this is the amount we're going to have in order to operate safely and soundly and to satisfy our prudential regulatory requirements, and it's the amount also, or a subset of it, that we're going to need in order to execute a resolution plan. So it basically serves those purposes. Now the question becomes, is this amount of liquidity, and the liquidity has to be the high quality liquid assets, and once again I said there's no stated preference with respect to treasuries, which is a high quality liquid asset, or reserves, is that amount a binding constraint? So I think that's the first question regulators can take a look at. Does this amount of liquidity necessary to successfully execute a resolution plan hit the threshold of being a binding constraint, or safety and soundness or other risk management liquidity requirements actually the binding constraints? Next question I would ask the regulators to take a look at is whether or not the expectations associated with resolution can be better communicated to the banks and to the systemically important financial companies with respect to some of the issues that have been raised today. So Governor Tarullo mentioned earlier daylight overdrafts, and that has basically created in resolution planning an issue with the willingness of institutions to go below a certain amount of reserves. Well, maybe, maybe not. I don't know the answer to that. But that's something that certainly can be looked at. And my recommendation would be for the regulators to both see whether or not there is a binding constraint that occurs with respect to the liquidity required in order to successfully execute a resolution plan, and then also whether or not other aspects of developing the models that are used to calculate the amount and the positioning of that, whether or not there are other aspects of that which in fact need to be reviewed in the context of how an institution operates in the business as usual environment.
Okay, I guess I'm on cleanup before we get to questions. So what I'm going to try to talk a little bit about is the impact of some of these regulations in aggregate, because you heard each of them described sort of individually, and some other interactions. And I'm going to take on first, though, just a couple of comments around regulations haven't changed much in the last couple of years, because a few of the different panels were talking about that. So therefore, how can it be an issue now? And the reality is, yes, we've been in implementation mode collectively in financial services. However, what has changed is the amount of excess reserves that Bill has been talking about is down dramatically. So when there was an awful lot going around, the impacts of optimization could be less obvious. So I think that's just important. So the fact that you haven't seen this before doesn't necessarily mean that it's not at all related to, although I would agree, no one should be running around and saying it's only about regulation. There's an awful lot going on here to point to any single variable and call that the major cause. The second thing that I would say with regard to sort of liquidity and liquidity management, I think it's very, very important to note that it's essential to keep the operating model functioning. But just like capital and financial stability, more is not always equal to better. You have to understand the aspects of liquidity and collateral and their importance in lubricating the system of financial services to make sure that cash moves from those that have it to those that need it. Trish talked a little bit about that as it related to, financing against collateral. Those are important aspects, and the key here is now finding the balance. Now, that said, I don't think it's about rolling back anything. And what do I think there's opportunity for? Well, we have a whole bunch of rules that target a lot of the same risks, many of them very highly and appropriately focused around short-term wholesale financing funding. Now, short-term wholesale financing, if I could speak. And here the issue is, Do each of those rules, as they layer on top of each other, make the system safer and sounder, or do they just change the cost? And I think that's an opportunity to take a look. Because if they're making the system safer and sounder, that's fine. Where they're just layered and don't contemplate the other rules that came before it that already address the risk, if it's dressed appropriately, well then, clearly, it's going to be a less attractive, less economic trade for the traditional intermediaries to go after. So on to sort of the remarks I prepared. Dislocations between cash and collateral on a temporary basis happen all the time. They have happened all the time. Again, you have different sectors operating with different criteria, and that's the norm. What is different is in today's environment, how the intermediaries function has changed. And of course it's changed. We've put in place a variety of different regulations to change the actual behavior, the amount of liquidity transformation that they did, the footprint, the size. So that can't be a surprise. But the real question is what we want to be intermediated actually being intermediated? So a couple of things that to think about is while requirements broadly changed, they've resulted in changing behaviors. They've also resulted in changes in how people interact in the short-term wholesale funding market and the economics of certain trades. And by the way, the economics of certain trades, most importantly, in that short-term wholesale funding space. So what does it look like these days? Banks have a lot more HQLA. That's a good thing, right? Because we should be able to collectively ensure in our financial system that liquidity stress can be met. As mentioned by some previous panels in here as well, the SLR and GSIB surcharges have been put in place, but they're size-based, not necessarily risk-based, so they can weigh more heavily, again, on this low-risk, low-margin U.S. Treasury financing. And why do we care? This is not about financial services institutions. We care because risk-based metrics around financing the Treasury market matter. They really do matter because we want to make sure that we maintain the health and soundness of the functioning of the financial markets. And by the way, that impacts the cost of debt financing for the economy, which means taxpayer value, right? And it also means that so many other corporate borrowings that are tied to the underlying cost of Treasury are impacted in price as well. So this is not about, again, banks per se, and I think that conversation has to be broader. It's really about the cost of financing for the government, the economy, as well as banking institutions. I think while binding constraints, people have mentioned them here, the reality is the framework, and I think Governor Tarullo would agree with this, the framework was written to make the bonding constraint move, right, through time and can be different based on a business model. Well, as a result, you actually have financial services institutions that are managing their capital and liquidity in a much more centralized way and with a lot less flexibility, with a lot more cushions, because the cost of getting it wrong is quite expensive. And moving to now a couple of other thoughts. While folks say, well, financial institutions have so much HQLA, and whether it's cash or it's treasury and so much in excess reserves, why didn't they show up in September? Right? Why didn't they show up? Well, just because their excess reserves were greater than the reserve requirement, it didn't mean that the cash on hand or the treasuries weren't earmarked for something else. And that goes back to some of the other comments that were made here. So firstly, Bill Nelson talked earlier about the volatility of settlements and the intraday overdrafts, right? This is really an important feature here. The largest banking institutions manage so many settlements, both in deposits and in securities. The quantum is enormous. It varies both in the size every single day as well as in the timing with which it occurs. So as a result, excess reserves are really the shock absorbers, right, to ensure that you don't breach intraday overdraft. Well, maybe there's not so much excess there, if you will, from a management perspective, because there's a stigma that is associated with that potential breach. There's also a low tolerance, as we talked about earlier, for any of those intraday overdrafts to occur. So there's a risk aversion. As excess reserves come down, guess what? There's a lot less willingness to lend out that last dollar because it could result in an overdraft. And it certainly, you wouldn't want it to result into an overnight loan that may not come back the next day in time to meet your next series of cash flow So besides that, the day-to-day management, you have this bank management liquidity stress testing, which is occurring monthly, right? Management teams can be more conservative than what the LCR is doing. So in fact, they're going to look at cash and securities, and they might, again, earmark a piece that they want to keep on their balance sheets. Talked about the non-public supervisory assessments as they relate to the comprehensive liquidity assessment, and then, of course, what we talked about related to resolution and recovery. Now, the resolution recovery one, I think, is very important because there is this distinction between our reserves preferred over treasuries. And the reality is we are financing today, earmarking today, liquidity and collateral for the potential eventuality of a substantial demise. And the real question is maybe there should be more fungibility between treasuries and reserves in that instance, because this is the nearly risk-free asset in the world that we're thinking about. And the other piece here, which we haven't spent a lot of time talking about, is the changing not only market dynamics, but also the market players. Everyone's mentioned asset managers, right? Asset managers have become substantially bigger participants in both auctions as well as in the repo market. You talked a little bit about the decline in repo. Over this course of the last year, a former colleague of mine, Alex, mentioned, you know, repo's up 30%. The repo market, repo financing is up 30%. No surprise. Why? Because the deficit's up, right? Well, who's doing all this repo? Well, you have the primary dealers that are underwriting all of these auctions, so it's sitting on their balance sheet. Well, who's financing them? Asset managers are financing them. Asset managers are providing $1.3 trillion, again, another number thanks to a former colleague of mine, Alex, $1.3 trillion in repo financing against U.S. Treasuries. That's up $300 billion year on year. And so when you saw that tax day change, well, there's a withdrawal, and a withdrawal from the money funds, as well as then a pullback from repo financing, because the bulk of that financing is done on an overnight basis. Why? Because money market funds also have new liquidity requirements, and they need to have highly liquid assets, hence their buyers of bills, and hence their big users of repo. So now you're faced with, well, you have a pullback by a sector driven by those types of criteria, nothing wrong with it. And by the way, think about the investment thesis. The investment thesis of govy funds is very similar, and the investor behavior of those that are putting money into them is equally very similar. So you've got a footprint that's more highly concentrated and operates in a very similar way. And there you come back to then, so now what? Who's going to provide that financing when those dislocations occur? Because the traditional intermediary may not, because of the increased cost of capital on these low-risk, low-margin activities, they're not likely to be the marginal buyer of repo or provider of financing in that environment. And I will stop there.
Okay. So thank you very much for very well-informed discussions. I'm going to start with one question for everybody. So you were all asked to focus on something specific, but let's assume the Fed increases its balance sheet a bit with the term and the repo that it's done. So there's a bit more reserves in the system. We're not operating, you know, on the steep part of the demand curve. If there were one change in regulations you would make that you think would help the repo market and sort of be narrow without, what would it be and what would its cost be in terms of financial stability or safety and soundness? So it looks like Tim is suggesting you start.
I'm suggesting anyone other than me start.
Nice.
So.
Being so close to Christmas, I can't possibly pass up, you know, the opportunity to.
What's an old friend for?
I think that's a really important question. And again, if I think about Christmas just a little bit, just a second more, you know, rather than sort of providing the answer around, well, I'd really like a pony or I'd really like a new iPod or something, I really think it's important to think, a change that I think would be very sensible and very useful for improving the repo market and potentially other markets too, but definitely the repo market, again, is for this point that I made at the end of my remarks, which is really for it to be the case that bank regulators think very seriously and very carefully about the impact of bank regulations on other markets, including the repo markets and the cash markets that repo markets are financing. And a point that was that I think I heard in Governor Tarullo's remarks this afternoon, and I'm sure he'll let me know if I misconstrued it, is that at some point, if we try to make the banks safer and safer and safer, especially with respect to a liquidity situation, we are going to make the rest of the system less safe. And I think that what you saw in the repo markets this September was a situation in which there was clearly a less permeable barrier between the banking system and the rest of the financial markets. And that is not necessarily isolated to the repo market. There are lots of markets that banks intermediate where that lack of permeability could be a problem. And I think that I think we should all agree from a sort of first principles perspective, what we should care about is maximizing financial stability in the U.S., and that is not always the same as maximizing financial stability, especially from a liquidity perspective, the banks. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Anybody else?
I would say that there was a comment made earlier, I think Sean made, I'll say the devil's in the details instead of God's in the details. And, a lot of this modeling is based, some of the modeling, not a lot, some of the modeling is based off of a point in time versus several points in time or rolling averages. And to the extent that there are models that deal with liquidity and capital, then perhaps taking a look at changing those to being averages or over multiple periods of time instead of points in time might be a worthwhile exercise, because it then avoids kind of the window dressing effect, the blip that you get where institutions start managing their balance sheets in order to satisfy a regulatory requirement. And to the extent that something can be done with respect to that, I think it'd be a worthwhile exercise to investigate it.
So I guess honestly, as I said before, I'm not sure that all the time has been taken to thoughtfully consider all of this. I can't really think offhand of a liquidity or capital regulation that I would trade, given what we just learned about the repo markets in the last couple of months. But I guess this is strangely, I may be agreeing with some of the comments made by some of the folks who've been weighing in on the sort of what's called the industry side of this one about the G-SIB surcharge calculation, but I don't think we have the same solution. If we're worried that that calculation actually is leading firms to take significant market-moving actions to do window dressing at the end of a period, I would actually measure the G-SIB surcharge at its peak point throughout the period so that a firm actually is, when it's at the point where it's the most systemically important, that is the capital that is required to hold.
So just to,
I don't think that's what they meant when they said it, but I think it's a good idea.
That would be really good for market continuity.
I have to say I'm so glad I retired. but one thing I will say is, several of you awesome guys up here have been talking also about window dressing, and there definitely is, institutions manage downward. But I think it's important to note, again, my past experience, is that you cannot engage in intermediating and use it as a spigot in a massive way, period, full stop. So, by the way, I'm not averse to going to sort of an averaging or reducing a step function, but I think it should be clear that it's not like folks are ramping up enormously and then slamming it down, because that's not acceptable to your underlying clients, and that's who you're providing intermediation for. You can't disappear. So for me, I think there are the couple things that I like the idea about treasuries potentially being considered as reserves, because that could free up potentially for intraday activity moving back and forth, and it doesn't add risk to the Fed or to the environment. That's sort of an interesting – I'm looking at Bill because he's the guy that put that one up there. I think that's a pretty interesting one. But I also think not getting rid of any one rule per se, but really looking at them now as a package, mm-hmm. because they are a package. When G-SIB surcharge, both the calculus as well as the rule itself were written, it was sort of assuming nothing else was in place, because nothing else was in place. But there is an awful lot of bits in place, and while we can all agree that, you know, resolution and recovery has come a long way, it may not be fully done for everybody. The reality is, if you've got lots of resolution and recovery in place, then the risk of systemic footprint that is meant to be mitigated by the GSIB surcharge, there's probably some offset that could occur there. So I would say look at it as a package and see where there's opportunity to unpack and, you know, sort of get the risk assessment right and the cost right, because if you get the cost right, more people will transact.
Okay, great. So let me, I want to follow up on, and I'll come back to your question, Tim. So I want to follow up on one thing, which is sort of market dynamism and the money markets and that sort of effect there. And Sandy, you mentioned the growth of money market funds and govy funds and big buyers of treasuries or reverse repo. And so is it your view that sort of concentration in this market, in the repo market, has changed, or it's more money funds and less dealers, or that is changing it? And is any of it due to some of it, of course, is money fund reform, yeah, but is any of it due to bank regulation?
Yeah, look, I think sort of all of the above. Firstly, anytime you add, you know, more diversity into the market, it's a good thing. I think my point is really the market's different, the players are different, and who's engaging day to day and what their behaviors are is fundamentally changed. Therefore, how we manage the flow of collateral and cash have to adjust accordingly. So when you think about the rule changes in asset management, that, you know, the two big ones were floating net asset value for prime funds. And what did we see? We saw over $1 trillion move out of prime and into govy funds, right? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the liquidity rules associated with both prime and govy funds that make sure that you have enough money on hand to meet the expectations and demands of those investors. Those bits, you know, they make really perfect sense. But that means you can have starts and stops on the financing. Doesn't mean it should go away, but it's a different characteristic. And you've got this push. Those liquidity rules actually push asset managers in money market funds to overnight repo. Well, they're not going to term out. So the answer isn't go term out. They're not going to do it in a substantive way because they need access to that liquidity, which is exactly the opposite of what you'd want the broker-dealers to be doing, which is take down term repo. So you've got a mismatch in the drivers for liquidity on both the buy side and the sell side. So how do you think about that? And particularly when it comes to, you know, sort of the U.S. Treasury market. So again, I don't think it's, you know, bad or wrong. It's just a matter of, so what do we do on those tax days? And how do we ensure that intermediation can occur appropriately or to the best of its ability, and where intermediation can no longer provide the elasticity of balance sheet, well, who can provide it for U.S. Treasuries? And that's where I think we've already seen the Fed stepping in. And the one other comment that I would make is with regard to, you know, buying bills, that's a really good idea, right? However, I would also say one of the largest buyers of bills these days are the govy funds themselves. So the question is, since they're buying them because they've had $500 billion worth of flows come into funds this year, are they really going to be willing to sell those bills in the size, the quantum, that the Fed wants? Or do you have to start thinking also about coupons? So, again, the behavioral, the drivers, they all need to be contemplated, and it's much more. It's not so binary, I guess.
So Nelly, if I could make one point. So I would say, the first thing I would say is that trying to understand whether or not the repo market is very concentrated is difficult, in my opinion, because there's a tri-party market, there's a bilateral market, the data's not where it needs to be. To the extent that that's occurring, things that I've been sort of hearing about and reading about, so and one thing that was already mentioned this afternoon is the increase in centrally cleared repo.
Yeah.
So that has the potential to give some rise to a little bit more concentration, because the way that those utilities are set up is that they have a relatively small set of members, at least now, that's growing over time, so that will improve, but right now it's a relatively small set of members. So then you ask yourself, well, why is that? Why are people going to centrally cleared repo? People are going to centrally cleared repo because the bank gets the netting benefit, and they get to cut it out of the SLR measure. Mm-hmm. It's a capital-related incentive. So we need to, this is exactly the point that I was trying to make earlier. We need to be asking the question, what is it in the capital regulations or the liquidity regulations or whatever else that's leading to these kinds of activities in other markets and closely related markets? And I think the centrally cleared repo example is a good example of where that's occurring.
I'm going to turn to the issue of rules versus supervision, because this has been a big issue lately. And so I'll start with Tim, and maybe Jim might want to say something, and others can join in. So in Q&A yesterday to some testimony that the Vice Chair Quarles gave at the House, I believe it was the House, he mentioned the Fed may have created some incentives that contributed to the spike in repo rates. And particularly among them are the internal liquidity stress tests that we run, quote unquote. So, but Tim, you just told us the Fed doesn't run the stress tests, the banks do. So could you just explain a little bit what...
Sure, yeah, happily. Let me start by expressing my gratitude that he used so many qualifiers in the statement, because it's clearly still very uncertain what the relationships are here. But the Fed, as I mentioned before, comprehensive liquidity analysis and review does not include a Federal Reserve stress test, and there are no binding minimum thresholds as any part of it. For the stress test part of this is the Federal Reserve assessing the firm's use of internal stress testing for liquidity management purposes. Jim actually said this quite nicely, but I'll reiterate it hopefully as well. I think what they mean, and I don't know this for sure, is that the preference for cash over securities that shows up in these internal stress tests is because, unlike in the LCR calculation, which appropriately, as I said before, treats treasuries and cash the same, a bank's liquidity stress test may not, and frankly, probably shouldn't. I don't know if this is exactly, well, actually not probably, it shouldn't. I don't know if this is exactly what they meant, but I'm assuming it. So put that another way, banks' liquidity risk managers and supervisors have learned a couple things from experience, thankfully, that turning treasuries into cash is different than having cash. First, you have to turn the treasury into cash. You have to either sell them or you have to use them as collateral and repo. Sometimes, particularly in a stressful environment, which is what stress tests are testing, and as a function of the size of the amount you need to sell, when you try to do that, you're not going to get as much as you would like. And you're not, you know, cash is cash. Treasuries are one step removed. They're extremely, they are the second most. But so it's actually, you know, I think reasonable for a large bank to be thinking about in the stressful environment in which it might have to unload a huge amount of treasuries to fund itself, to get cash, either, again, through selling it, through repos, using it as collateral, et cetera, that the hit, the haircut they could take could be quite large. That's a very rational concern of the banks, borne out by history, a rational concern, I think, for supervisors to be thinking about. In fact, I'd go a little bit further. If risk managers and management of the banks aren't doing that, then I think it would be kind of frightening. And if they're not making it clear to their boards of directors that a bank might have to spend a few extra dollars to build a liquidity pool because in the event of stress, their treasuries might not be worth 100 cents on the dollar when they sell hundreds of billions of them at the same time, then I think they wouldn't be doing their job very well. So that's my view.
I mean, the only comment I'd add to that is much of this is nuanced, okay? And you know, the discussion of preference versus incentives versus, you know, requirements versus, you know, regulations, whatever. I mean, the reality is that I think the communication between the regulated entities and their supervisors is extraordinarily important. And that communication needs to be clear. And I think a lot of it actually could be more transparent. I think Tim mentioned this earlier, that it would be nice to have a little greater transparency in the supervisory world. Once you get on the outside, you appreciate it more than when you're on the inside. I can say that from experience. But the reality is that, you know, the communication is extraordinarily important. And if, for example, an aspect of resolution planning is being unintentionally carried over into business as usual, then there should be a discussion around that. And there shouldn't be a reluctance to talk about it. And there might be very rational reasons why it makes sense. I mean, as Tim indicated, I mean, I think, you know, it's a very reasonable assumption that if you're selling a lot of an asset class into a market, there's going to be a haircut that is taken at that point in time, regardless of what the asset class is. And so having a discussion around this, it just serves in anybody's interest, and hopefully we'll make the system better.
Just again, I think back to, you know, the LCR, the CLR, and the resolution recovery. That's a continuum of stress tests, right? And while I agree completely with the LCR and agree completely with the CLR, because you are liquidating under stress, and if you're liquidating a treasury bill, it's going to have or note, it's going to have different aspects given size versus depth. The question that I would posit, though, is for resolution and recovery, right? Resolution and recovery, are we making the right trade-off between holding massive amounts of cash up front because it's preferable to treasuries for what is a low probability outcome? And one can argue, so what? Let's have it that way. But then we can't be surprised of the consequences of lots of cash and liquidity sitting on financial institutions' balance sheets that are not available for the traditional daily operating of movement of cash and securities through the system. That's the only one I'm thinking.
Can I just before I pass it? I just want to be clear, because part of the point appears to be so CLR and resolution and recovery are not the same thing.
They're different. Mm-hmm. They're very
right?
different.
So what I was talking about was CLR and risk management, and fortunately, Jim can talk about resolution and recovery.
And you know, with respect to, for example, an incentive to hold cash versus an explicit preference to hold cash, it goes back to the question is, what's behind the incentive? And if, in fact, the incentive is to avoid daylight overdrafts at the bank, because this liquidity is just more than at the bank level. The liquidity in resolution planning is for the entire enterprise, and much of the liquidity demands is actually driven, the acute liquidity demands is driven by the broker-dealer affiliate. When you're looking at the resolution plan quantum liquidity requirements, and what that is composed of, you really need to break down what is your objective associated with that. And if, in fact, for example, build confidence, avoid intraday or daylight overdrafts, you know, that's an issue. And if the requirement is, well, you need this level of cash to do that, then you have to have a discussion about the balance and the trade-offs associated with it. Okay.
So if we can turn to anyone has a question, if you raise your hand, there are some microphones, either that or I'm going to ask a couple more as we're getting ready.
I've worn them
okay.
down.
So I'm going to just raise one. I'm going to put Sean on the spot for a second. Because I know. But he always... so the GSIB sort of suggests that there are some capital and balance sheet constraints over year end. That it's not clear the Fed putting reserves in the system solves that problem, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
So how concerned are you about year end?
So again, I think it's I'd like to address the sort of the first point you made, which is this issue about putting reserves in the system. I think there are real questions about whether or not that is going to work if the primary intermediaries that intermediate those reserves feel as though they're full up for the end of the year.
Yep.
Seems
yep,
like
sure.
a really, you don't need a PhD in anything to get that one, in my opinion. The second point is, am I worried? So, in some cosmic sense, if I look back at last year, you know, there was definitely something that went on in repo markets last year. It didn't get the same press that the September event I got, and not much has changed in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're heading into another year end.
It wasn't a crisis.
That's true too. So we're heading into another year end. So do I think that there's a possibility, or is there scope for there to sort of be end-of-the-year volatility that is driven by that regulation? Yes, I think there is. Do I think it's going to be result in a financial crisis, or it's going to be something that the world can't handle? No, I don't think that, broadly mm-hmm. speaking. But actually, this gets to a broader point, which was raised several times during the presentations today, so I want to address it now, which is there's been this point made a number of times, which is like, well, volatility is good, and a little volatility is a good thing, so what's the worry? So the worry is, if the volatility is self-inflicted because of a design flaw in regulation, we should all agree that that's a mistake. And we should all agree to take a hard look at that and fix it if possible. So I would be, as an economist, I would be the first thing to say that volatility is healthy in the economy, and that sources of volatility beget trade and exchange of views, and that's good in a healthy economy and also in a democratic society. But if the volatility is being driven effectively by a design flaw in the underlying regulation, there is no good argument for not addressing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes.
From the ground?
Okay. Yes. Dennis, yes. If you stand up, I have all kinds of questions I could ask.
I
saw one person in the crowd raise their hand, so I thought we'd give it a shot.
I don't know if I want to go before Bill. I think I want to go after Bill. But Dennis Kelleher from Better Markets. You know, one thing that's it's interesting, and Sean just alluded to this, but a theme through all three panels is that September, nobody thinks that's going to lead to a major crisis and a failure, kind of a cascading failure. So other than Sean's question earlier about maybe it's a leading indicator, but maybe it is. But let's leave that small probability aside and say there's broad agreement that that doesn't mean we're going to have 08 all over again. And Sean just said, as for end of the year, you know, could we have increased volatility? Yes. Are we going to have a massive collapse of the financial system? No. Everybody's saying it. And that's the forest that occasionally gets mentioned. And the rest of the time, we're talking about the trees, and the particular tree, which is the repo market. But I think one of the reasons is broad agreement that none of this is going to lead to a collapse or a cascading crisis is because at the macro level, we have massive resiliency now. Now, maybe it's not where it should be. Maybe there should be more capital. And yes, it's better than 08, but is it where it should be? I don't know. But it's certainly miles and miles away from where we were in 08 in terms of resiliency. And that's because of numerous rules, regulations, changes in practice, changes in markets. And so you're saying if there's a design flaw in this particular market, and then Sandra and you both talk about there being many markets, we're only talking about one, there's a little change here, and let's a little change here. And each change you're talking about relates to capital and liquidity. That's what makes it so stable at the macro level, though. That's why everybody here can so comfortably say it didn't lead to a crisis in September, and it probably won't lead to a crisis in December. The macro level, the resiliency and stability there is what gives you that comfort. And so when you talk about the changes at the micro level, are you worried about each one cumulatively leading to a question for your overall conclude your premise of all these discussions of the resiliency at the macro level?
So I don't think you've appropriately characterized why I'm not worried. So it has nothing to do with the fact that we have so much resiliency in the banking sector that we don't have to worry about anything. It has everything to do with the fact that we're in basically a 3.8% unemployment macroeconomy. It's the strongest macroeconomy we've seen in a generation, maybe in 50 or 60 years. And right now we are at the top of a very robust macroeconomic business cycle. As was already raised earlier by other people today, we can't be sure how this will affect the economy and the markets if we were in a much more precarious economic situation. No one has repealed the business cycle. We're in a really good spot today. I would grant you that part of that is probably due to the significant improvements in capital liquidity that has happened from the crisis, but that is absolutely not the sole reason, and that does not portend that these problems, if they raise their heads in the future, couldn't be a problem. And I think this also, you know, this is an important point because we're having a conference today about sort of the repo market problems that occurred in September. Who wants to put an X on the calendar for the future Brookings Institution sort of seminar on the volatility that occurred in, say, the corporate bond market? And some of the fundamental concerns with these regulations that are being discussed today have the potential to cause volatility in those markets just in the way they did in the repo market, and that may not occur at a point in time when the unemployment rate is only 3.8 or 4%.
Can we just take a couple more questions and then?
Yeah, I just slight response though, but there's a there,
no.
There's a. I'm not even sure how to respond to what Sean just said, but there is an extent to which regulations have made the system safer and more resilient. That's a good thing. Have those regulations created some incremental volatility in markets that have been incredibly unvolatile? I'm really not even sure what your point is, to be honest, on that one. But so I guess are you arguing that we need to roll back regulations that make the banks safer in order to?
No, I'm saying if you find a design flaw in a regulation that is adding volatility that does not have any policy goal attached to it, then that's a source of inefficiency that you should squeeze out of the system. That would be the same if you were building a car or a house. It has nothing to do with regulation or it's basic efficiency in trying to govern a system. If there's something that's wrong, that doesn't have any policy benefit associated with it, let's not have it. If we can't agree on that, I think we don't have much to talk about.
Yeah. So,
okay. So, Bill, question from Bill Nelson.
Melly, I got to say something too. Sorry.
We haven't found anything.
But I think you talk about what is volatility is fine. You have to look at what the driver of volatility is, and we've already discussed that some of the drivers of volatility here is because the capital associated with intermediating and financing of U.S. Treasuries is oversized. Right? And therefore, it's capital and liquidity. They're different things. What we're talking about here is not a liquidity issue. We're talking about a financing issue, moving funding from one place to the other. There's not an inadequate stock of liquidity. There's not an inadequate stock of cash. Right. So you come back to, and this is Sean's point, and I agree with him completely, if the volatility is driven by the fact that banks won't intermediate because we've gotten the cost of capital for low-risk activity wrong, we should contemplate trying to get it right and try to rebalance it so that we can have institutions engaging in that marketplace to support the financial plumbing. And by the way, it doesn't just matter for the financing and repo markets. HQLA and treasuries are critical to every aspect of our operating economy. There is no intraday unsecured overdraft anywhere anymore. Everything must be collateralized. For centralized clearing to work, it's all supported by collateral. So if our collateral markets don't function adequately and we don't get the velocity of collateral right because we don't have proper capital tied to treasuries, not anything else we're talking about here, well, then we're going to have a fundamental issue.
So I do want to add just quickly, I really need to. We have discussed that issue, I agree. I don't think we've agreed or proven, actually, the relationship between the capital and the assets. So I just want to be clear.
Yeah, and I just want to make one comment about volatility, and that is I really am in the camp it's a good thing. And the reason why it is a good thing is because it's going to bring new entrants into this market. Volatility means the opportunity to make money, simply.
I think we
But durability will matter. Durability will matter.
References to volatility today, just to be clear. I think there's a little bit of confusion. I'll just clarify. So there's volatility in short-term money markets, where ample reserves and the huge excess reserves may have stamped out for a while, and so you're not seeing any fluctuations there or any measurement of credit risk even in the short-term markets because it's all. And then there's volatility from spikes at quarter end and year end and lead-ups to reporting dates. So I think we're talking about two different things, and I just want to be clear. So I am really taking a couple questions in the floor. Okay. And then Bill Nelson, and then one more, and that's it. And then we'll take all three, and then we can. Thank you.
I think since
please
most of the
your name and where you're from, please.
I'm from the IMF. My name's Manmohan Singh. Although the topic is repo, the cash to collateral exchange happens in many markets: sec lending, prime brokerage, OTC derivatives. We understand the importance of repo market, especially the U.S. Treasury market. Now, if the Treasury, the U.S. Treasury market, cannot find room in balance sheet space, when I mean balance sheet, I also mean off balance sheet, because when you read the 10-Ks, a lot of this flows off balance sheet.
Yeah.
There has to be a way to either make reserves and Treasury equal, either find balance sheet space for Treasuries or make the reserves unattractive. Has the thought of lowering IOER so that there is more of an equilibrium between U.S. Treasury choice and reserve choice, assuming we can't find the balance sheet space?
Yeah. Thank you. Bill Nelson.
Hi. Thank you, Bill Nelson from the Bank Policy Institute. So I'll just note that I think the only two things that I've heard the bank representatives to suggest is encouraging supervisors and banks to not have an unwarranted bias towards reserves and to calculate the G-SIB surcharge on an average basis rather than on a year-end basis.
Or a peak.
That doesn't sound like a big ask or, in fact, an easing. But in any case, let me then raise a couple issues. So,
Is there a question at the end of
there's two questions.
Okay.
So when you go back to watch the video in which the board adopted the ESLR and the SLR, every board member around the table said, we're doing so because it is our expectation that as the G-SIB surcharge rolled in, but anyway, it's our expectation that this will not be the binding constraint. Now, my colleague Francisco Covas at BPI has done some great work calculating what's the binding constraint for everyone. And what he's concluded is that for half the banks, the binding constraint is actually the SLR requirement in the stress tests. Mm-hmm. So my question is that an intended outcome, and is it a desirable outcome? The other question is, with respect to thinking about what an institution should do that's under stress, that has a big pile of treasuries, isn't that exactly what the discount window is for? Yeah. And if that doesn't have a market impact, in fact, it isn't even visible. And so if the answer is yes, then, well, shouldn't that be the plan? And isn't why not collateralize by treasuries, envision them using the discount window?
Okay. Thank you.
Short answers. No, I don't think we really have to stop. So okay. I think we should answer these.
This is like, if anyone wants to respond, please, but short. Thank you.
Should the post-stress leverage ratio be a binding constraint? Is that what your question was? So I think leverage ratio in stress is actually a pretty good measure, personally. I think that it does a few things. It's nice and simple, as leverage ratios are designed to be, but it actually has the benefit of being risk-sensitive as well. So you have an ending number post the stress that's actually very easy to understand. This is my capital. These are my assets. Right? If you remember back to the crisis, 2008, there were analysts all over the place doing these post-stressed tangible common equity analyses that were freaking out the market. And that's, in a sense, this is a nice consistent way to get the information out to the public that actually something approaching a post-stress tangible common equity ratio, here it is. That's the post-stress leverage ratio. Is it a good constraint? I'm not sure. Constraint of what?
So we could pick up on that just a little bit. Yeah.
I would just quickly address Bill's point about the discount window, yes. Which I basically agree with completely, but I think ultimately there's sort of there's a human behavior sort of stigma issue associated with that, which would make it really hard to even in the best of circumstances, if the Fed would roll into every large bank and say, look, really, we mean it, there'll be no consequences, so on and so forth, it could be very, very, very hard for banks to internalize that and ultimately to use it. I think that getting rid of that stigma problem, at least if I understood your question correctly, could be very, very difficult.
And to wrap up that last piece, too, is when it doesn't matter if people like or dislike the supplementary leverage ratio, it is embedded in banks' models, period, full stop, whether it's binding or not binding. And I think it's very important to note that the market is functioning very well in that construct because despite the fact that it's not a good risk reward on capital, it is part of the business model and the offering that needs to be provided in the services to underlying clients. The piece I think we need to focus on is that incremental support in intermediating, not business as usual. Why are financial institutions not leaning in? Why are they not showing up? And in that construct, maybe there's opportunity there to think about if you're fully in excess, if you are compliant with every rule out there, is there ability to deploy then these excesses into the market without drawing yet more incremental capital? That may also be a way to facilitate that incremental piece of intermediation. Yeah.
So I know this could go on for another 6 hours, but I don't intend to spend six more hours on the repo market. But I do want to thank all the panelists. I thought this was a really good discussion of an important issue. One of our goals was to kind of try and get people together to talk about something for which there have been a lot of headlines, but I don't think there's been much understanding, and I hope we've at least advanced that a small way. So I want to particularly thank Nellie for helping me organize this and all the people who came to speak.
Thank you.